Okay, so it is January 10th, and this is an interview with Laura Unger. Debbie Goldman's taking the lead in the interview with Jeff Reckenbach on the, Zoom from Cleveland. Laura and I are in Washington, D.C. Laura, we'll start at the beginning. Tell us when you were born and where, and a little bit about that community and your family.
Yeah. I was born April 1st, 1949. I grew up mainly in Queens, Little Neck, Queens, which is the last town in Queens before you hit Nassau County. So we were always a little bit disliked the people across the border in Great Neck, the kids with cars while we had bicycles. My father was a defense attorney. He had multiple sclerosis, though, so the last few years he couldn't practice. He was in a wheelchair and died when I was 13. I still get choked up. I can't believe I'm getting choked up. And so he died when I was almost 14. And they were just liberal Democrats, not very political. My father was an officer in B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League. My mother was teaching English just as they started organizing the teachers union in New York City. She had mixed feelings about it because she felt like it, she felt a little bit that it restricted her ability to do volunteer work after work. But you know, she, the older she got, the more liberal she got. She was definitely pro-union by the time, by the end of my, her life, she was actually fairly, she kept moving left as she got older and older, which was wonderful. I went to a public high school, Bayside High School, just at the time that they started integrating the school. It was a huge school, 5,000 kids. They started busing people in from Jamaica and Flushing, which were more black. I joined the Congress of Racial Equality.
In high school?
In high school. And started going to demonstrations when I was in high school. Basically influenced by two things. I think I had a neighbor who, friend who was very political. His family was political and he's got me involved in things. Actually, he's a fairly well-known labor historian, Josh Freeman. He wrote the book on labor in New York. But also I had a counselor in camp who was probably one of the biggest influences on my life. He was a, his name was Paul McGowan. Nobody cares about that. But he sort of took me under his wing after my father died and really spent a lot of time with me talking politics and getting me involved in things. In fact, a whole group of us. So I started going to demonstrations in the city when I was still in high school. I used to sneak into the city.
The city meaning?
Yeah, when I was in high school, tell my mother I was doing something else, then go to demonstrations and try to avoid TV cameras.
What was your maiden name?
My maiden name was Rose. Laura Ann Rose was my name.
Your last name was?
Rose.
R-O-S-E.
R-O-S-E. So when I got married and took Nick's name, I basically dropped the N, and now my name is Laura Rose Unger. So,
what camp did you go to?
It was a YMHA camp where I met him. And then I went to NYU. I don't know how far you want me to go on this.
I think you're doing great. Keep going.
I actually wanted to go to Cornell ILR. I desperately wanted to go there. Both of my sisters went to Cornell. They both went to home ec. That's what it was called in those days. I refused to do that. I thought it was insulting. So I applied to ILR and got rejected. They took six women that year, which I found out about 20 years later when I was on an advisory board for Cornell for Women in Work, and there was a professor there. And everybody's introducing themselves with all their academic credentials. And I told them what my labor credentials were and said, and I got rejected from Cornell in 1966. And she patted my hand and said, "Don't feel bad, dearie. They only took 6 women that year." So I wanted to stay in the city. Most of my friends were going to CUNY, the City University of New York, which was in Harlem. My mother was afraid of me going there. So at the last minute, I applied to NYU, which was much easier to get into then. I was not a great student. And ended up, my mother got me married then to somebody who could afford it, and I went to NYU.
And is that where you did your undergraduate, or did you transfer?
No, I did my, if you can call it undergraduate work, that's what I did my, that's where I did my political work.
And what did you major in?
English.
Okay, and talk about your political work then at NYU. This is now what years?
We're talking 1966 to 1970, which was basically the height of the anti-war movement. The year I got there, actually, they raised the tuition to $2,400, which is like nothing. But we had a sit-in, which I was involved in, where the students sat in and took over the main building and to fight against the tuition increase. I'm sure we lost. I don't remember, but I'm sure we lost. I got involved with the NYU Students Against the War, and eventually SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, because I didn't think being against the war was enough. That was the time the Panther 21 were in jail, and so I was very involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and the women's movement, and I was looking for an organization that covered all the bases, and that was SDS. We were involved in some labor things there. The maintenance workers went on strike, and we supported the maintenance workers on strike. That was on the good side. On the bad side, I don't know if people remember, there was like a riot of construction workers. It marched up through Manhattan, and we had been doing a lot of stuff in the 1970, which was Kent State. And they marched up and got to try to beat up some of the anti-war students. That was, so I saw both sides of the labor movement, but I was always interested in the labor movement.
Okay. Anything more you want to say about your radicalization through high school and college?
I think that's pretty much it, except that I met, that's where I met Nick.
Nick Unger.
Yeah, my husband. And he was he was actually a physics, studying physics at NYU, which was strange because he's completely not interested in physics. I started going out with Nick then, and he is much more, generational political background than me, and I'm sure that, enforced my, not only my activism then, but, continuing activism through the rest of my life. I mean, there was no way to be married to Nick and not, which we got married in 73, and not be political for my whole life, so.
If you're willing to, can you talk a little bit about Nick's family background and his political legacy, which is very important?
Yeah.
You don't want to. Okay. We can go on.
I'm not sure. Except, all I can say, I'll say about Nick is that he comes from a multi-generational political, left political family. His father was a lawyer who actually defended me when I got arrested for spray painting Free the Panther 21 on a wall in NYU. he defended a lot of Puerto Rican nationalists, and his mother was also a writer and poet and political organizer, since she was 16 or 17. So he has a long history.
Okay, you graduate from college. Tell us a little bit about your life before CWA, before the telephone company.
I had no intention of becoming an English teacher. I was not interested in it. And I'll tell you the truth, I mean, I hardly went to any classes in 1970 because it's funny because I made Dean's List that year because all my teachers were picked because they were also political. So I had no right to teach English and I had no interest in teaching English. A group of us decided to become community organizers. We moved to Saddlebrook, New Jersey. It was a complete flop.
I didn't hear where in New Jersey?
Saddlebrook, New Jersey, because that's where we could find cheap housing. That was pretty much a flop. Moved back to New York, worked a variety of jobs. Worked at Leviton, which is an electrical factory, making dimmer switches. I was a member of IBW. It was awful. My, the shop steward was basically the most senior person and woman in the office, and she didn't do anything. When I got pregnant with Katie at the time, I called the benefits to find out what my benefits were, and they said, IBW, everything's covered, 100%, $250 a day. They said, well, what does your husband work? I said, it's not my husband, it's me. I work at Leviton. Sorry, wrong number. it was the benefits at the factory were $45 a day. So a progressive doctor who was my gynecologist, got me onto Medicaid because it was a minimum wage job. I learned I was soldering electrical switches. So I had Katie at Lenox Hill Hospital, my daughter. And when I went to get back to work, they refused to give me my job back. And I went back to work 3 weeks. I left work a week before I had her and went back 3 weeks, tried to go back 3 weeks after because they had no maternity leave policy. And they refused to give me my job back. Fortunately, that year, New York State had just passed the law saying that they had to hire you back after. So I had to go. IBW wouldn't do anything. I had to go to the Human Rights Commission on my own, and they gave me my job back. And 6 months later, I got laid off anyway.
How old were you in what year?
Pardon me?
How old were you when Katie was born?
27.
Okay.
I worked then at the New York Public Library, which was a great job. The pay wasn't so good, but it was AFSCME. But we had wonderful benefits. We had good benefits. We had a tremendous amount of time off. I got to work in the 42nd Street Library, which is a gorgeous place to work. It was, I wasn't very active in the union there, but it was a good union job. I got laid off. I worked in a lot of print shops, mostly off the books, because I had learned how to do newspapers and cartooning and layout, I guess, during my time at NYU, because we had leaflets and newspapers. And I was famous for doing beautiful banners, but I always made a spelling mistake, so I always had to go back and fix it. It was like my signature. So I was able to get jobs in print plants because I knew how to do layout. One of the places I worked, they tried to organize. It was a big shop. Varick Street in New York used to be sort of the print capital of New York City.
What street?
Varick Street. A lot of the stuff since has moved to Philadelphia and other places. But we made a good attempt to try to organize. But the problem was is the shop next door had been on lockout for years. And there was one old woman retiree who was in front of that building every day, with her sign saying we are locked out. And I think that did more than anything to hurt our organizing drive because people said, well, what's the point? But I did get picked to be on a committee to try to negotiate some things with the company, but those things never work if you don't have real power behind you. I worked at UPS. I tried to get a job as UPS at UPS as a driver, in the truck. They were very discriminatory against women, obviously. and I could lift 50 pounds at that point. You know, I was very strong. I had a brown belt in karate, which I took when I was at NYU. And they refused. They said I can work as a clerical, as a customer service worker, which was a horrible job. It was taking complaints and taking orders over the phone. It was very stressful. I used to smoke a pack and a half, you know. But the good thing about it, it had fairly flexible hours, which I needed.
And now, did you have a second child?
At that point, I had not had David yet. And it was not unionized. They never tried to organize the customer service workers, the Teamsters. The best thing about the job, it was near Broadway, and all of the a lot of actors would work there because they could run out and leave to do auditions. But I think that job actually really helped me a lot because it when I became local president and I started bargaining and for customer service workers, I knew about, you know, the automatic systems, and I knew what happened because we used to have to do an average of, I remember, 2.5 minutes on a call. You know, I still remember, you know, you never forget. UPS, can I help you? You know, the package has to be measured in a certain way, and you had to explain to people how to do it. You had to tell people, you know, that they were now going to find their lost packages, and that because they didn't, that was before barcodes. That was a very useful job for me.
Was it stressful?
Very, yeah. But while I was working there, a friend of mine who had gotten a job at AT&T before me said they were still hiring women under the consent decree. They still had to, they had fulfilled their quota under the consent decree. So I applied to be a comm tech. Nick tutored me in math so I could pass the test. So I was terrible in math. They tried to get me to take a job as an operator because I applied around Christmas time.
What year?
This was 1970, the end of 1978. I asked them, well, what if my Comtech job opens up because I had passed the test? And they said, well, you know, if you sign up to be an operator, you're obligated to finish that out. You know, so I didn't take the job. And then a couple of months later, I got called. The only other people in my that class, because they put you through a training, were all women and a couple of vets because they were still hiring veterans. So those were the only men in the class.
So briefly explain what the consent decree was. Went into effect in 1973.
There was a Department of Justice suit, right?
Against, EEOC.
I'm sorry.
That's
an
okay.
EEOC case against AT&T for discrimination. 99.something% of women were operators. The same percentage of men were technicians. There clearly showed a pattern of discrimination. And AT&T finally agreed somewhat voluntarily to... or involuntarily, to start reversing that. So that meant that they hired a lot more women technicians. They actually hired some men to be operators. In fact, two of my offices in my local were men who had been hired as operators. The interesting thing, though, is that when the men were hired as operators, they were either promoted very quickly to be comtechs, or they were given the higher operator title, like the SA title. So I know that happened to a couple of guys in my local, but I was able to go directly into being a communications technician.
So tell us a little bit about, how long was your training?
It was much shorter by then. I mean, it was really a joke because by that time they were already slightly beginning to automate things. So they really cut the, not nearly as badly as they did a few years later, but they cut the training down. But the first thing you had to go through was a program called D18, which was basically you go through the modules on your own. And what I found out very quickly from other people is that if you finish quickly, you had a chance of being put on the test board. If you didn't, and particularly with women, there were communications technicians jobs that were still mainly clerical, which is like things like reviewing tickets and doing trouble tickets, which is what we had to handwrite, you know, and they called an analysis on the tickets. I desperately did not want to do that. I wanted to be on the test board. So I think I was the first one in my class to finish D18, and I got put onto a test board.
D18 or 80? What did you say?
D18.
And what's a test board?
A test board is, I worked for AT&T, it was long lines at that point. So we tested long distance circuits. So we never actually went out to the field. It was a huge board with cords, and we dealt with business customers at that point, and that office at 33 Thomas Street in downtown New York City.
33 what?
Thomas Street in downtown New York City. And business customers mainly would call in problems on their circuits, and with different test equipment that we plugged into the test board, we would try to find out what the trouble was and either fix it ourselves if it was in the long distance network or refer it to one of the local companies, mainly Verizon for us, New York Tel, I guess.
You would identify the source of the problem, which was a physical problem?
We didn't actually fix much of anything unless sometimes things could be fixed just by sending voltage out onto the line, but anything that had to be actually really physically done, I mainly didn't do that work.
And how many people were in your office?
It was three shifts, and it was about 60 people on my floor. There was about another floor of about the same amount that did the same thing. The whole building probably had about 500 people in it at that point when I started.
And when you began, how many women were on the test board?
In my office, there were maybe five or six of us out of 30. And then upstairs, there were a few more.
And how was the relationship with the guys?
You know, it varied. You know, it was a strange time because the older technicians wore suits and ties. They wore white shirts and ties even though they didn't have to. The guys who came from Vietnam, you know, were not going to put up with any of that. The guys who had been vets. And so there was a real dichotomy in the office between some of the older guys and some of the young guys. And, you know, at the beginning, there was some trouble. A lot of the training was on-the-job training, and some of the guys were very helpful, and some of the guys refused to help me at all. I remember one time where I had to put up what's called a patch, where you move a circuit from one spot to another. It was very complicated. And one of the guys who refused to help me at all, Eddie McCabe, I remember his name, after I did that, he said, okay, you can learn. And after that, he not only did he, did he teach me a lot, but he also became one of my big supporters when I started running for office.
So you kind of had to prove yourself.
You really had to prove yourself, and you had to have a somewhat thick skin. I came out of the women's movement and stuff, but I'm very confident, you know, physically, you know, I have my brown belt, you know. I got treated, I think, a little bit differently because of the way I carried myself, I think. And also I got active in the union. The thing that sort of put a hitch in that is that 2 months after I started, I got pregnant with David. Celebratory. So I knew that if they saw I was pregnant, they would take me off the test board. So
For health and safety reasons?
No, because of discrimination. So I actually just started, as soon as I found out, I started wearing bigger and bigger clothing on purpose. I was told that a lot of people gain weight when they start working there anyway, because, you know, people go out to lunch and they drink a lot and things. I didn't tell the company that I was pregnant until I finished my last training class, because they sent us to training in different places. So I came, I guess I was about 6 months pregnant. They sent me to Albany for my last training. I came back and I told my manager that I was pregnant. So I was almost 7 months pregnant before I told them.
You had David. Now you had benefits.
I had David, and I had a few months. AT&T did have some problem. You know, I think I lost service for it. But I came back after about 5 months, actually. I was bored stiff at home. I tried to come back a little earlier, but there was a transit strike in New York, and I couldn't get to work, so I put it off for another week and came back.
You said that you think you lost service while you were out on pregnancy. Was that eventually resolved through a suit?
No, straightened out for the case that they filed was Verizon. It was not. We never got that settled in AT&T, so a lot of us lost, not for the disability part of it, but for the after, you know, if we took any kind of leave time, we lost service for that.
I mean, if you took leave beyond the disability, the 6 weeks or whatever,
right,
for pregnancy disability, because I think by then the Pregnancy Disability Act had been passed.
Yeah, so they had to take, so they covered that time, but they didn't cover the couple of months after. I was allowed to take it without losing my job, but not without losing service.
And I'm sorry.
No, so when I came back, you know, and I was so touched because the guys, I mean, I only worked there a few months and they collected, you know, they did a collection for me. You know, they people were really wonderful. I started loving them. And when I came back, a woman that I had started with, the shop steward there, Bob Swanson, ended up deciding not to be shop steward anymore. And a woman that I started with became shop steward, and I became the alternate shop steward. So the assistant, you know, one. So I really jumped at that point into activism in the union.
Was that an elected position or a volunteer position?
I think.
Or how did you get?
I think it was only elected if somebody else wanted it, which they didn't. But I should backstep a little bit here.
Okay, good.
By the time I started in the phone company, there was a group in AT&T called the Bell Busters.
By the way, what local were you in?
It was 1150.
Okay.
And the Bell Busters was a little rank and file group that was dissatisfied with the local leadership. And they had a newspaper, which was well loved. We did a Mother of the Month, you know, column focusing on each month on a terrible local supervisor. You know, we just basically reported on things that the regular union newspaper didn't support. They had tried to run a campaign and had not. I think one person from the Bell Busters was actually the operator services vice president. But they hadn't won for president ever. The president, I'm trying to remember exactly, but there was an election for president and of a slate, and I think the Bell Busters slate lost. But they were really well respected, and you know, those were the times when the membership meetings got fairly raucous. And
And how many people would come to these meetings?
Well, the membership meetings?
Mm-hmm.
A few hundred. I mean, you know, hundreds. I mean, at that, but which was good for that, because the local was very spread out. It was New York and New Jersey, Long Island. When I first got there, we still had about 800 operators left from the New York City. It was the New York City International Operating Center. We had clerical workers and we had technicians, and it was very spread out. So it was hard to get people in for membership meetings, you know, but they were big enough to fill a church, which is where we had them. But so when I got back, the, you know, the Bell Busters was still active, and I was the shops. In fact, I think both of us were Bell Busters. And that's, you know, got a lot of experience on the newspaper. The guy who won for president, Gary Whaley, when I got back.
Whaley.
The operators had a walkout. He had a nervous breakdown. The vice, Gary did. He locked himself in the bathroom. His wife had to come get him out. and so he stepped down, and the vice, his vice president took over. His name was Chet Macy.
And Chuck Macy?
Chet Macy. I think he sort of recognized the importance of the Bell Busters, and actually asked me to work on the local newspaper. And that's when I started really working, doing some stuff for the local. I worked on the local spirit, and that became a very important thing for both me and for, I think, a lot of people around the country, because it was a lot different than a lot of the other local newspapers. We really tried to go deep into issues, and it was well respected. So that's when I really started working for the local. I worked on doing the work on my local newspaper.
Tell us a little bit more about the local spirit.
We won 9 newspaper awards at the convention over the years, including 5 first place awards. And we really tried to do, you know, once I became, I think one of the reasons I got elected secretary treasurer the first time is because between the Bell Busters and the local spirit, where I wrote several columns, did a lot of the cartoons, people really knew my name. So as hard as it was, because the size of the local, you know, to get yourself well known enough to run for office, everybody knew me because of the paper.
Was it only a AT&T local?
It was only an AT&T local. I mean, we organized a couple of little Wire Connect companies eventually.
And we're talking early 80s. How many people in the local about?
Once we started, when I think I first started, we had about 2,500. The local used to have about 7,000 because of when we had a big operating center. But by the time I came, we had about 2,400, 2,500. And so it was a good sized local, not one of the biggest by far, but it was a local that that really had very unstable leadership. There was never an elected officer who got elected twice. Never. We never had a 2-term president until me. You know, the guys would, you know, it was a typical old boys local. I mean, the operators were probably, they were happy to walk out anytime you asked them to. You know, they were militant, but in terms of real leadership in the local, there really wasn't much real leadership in the local. You know, the local office would be empty in the afternoons because they'd be out drinking, you know. So it was not a well-run local at all. And considering our size, which wasn't huge but was big, we really didn't have a lot of respect, I don't think, nationwide at that early on, which is one of the things that really I was able to change, I think. One of the early things I did, though, before I ran for local office, and I think this is important, when they shut down the IOS, the International Operating Center, it was, you know, the history of the operating centers where it started out, a lot of Irish women originally, and then they started hiring black women in New York City, and by the time they shut it down, it was almost, I would say, it was a lot. It was like 90% black, right? So when they shut it down, I don't know why he asked me to do this, but Chet asked me, the president asked me to see if I can organize a rally in support of the shutdown. And because of my political history before and the fact that I knew about other organizations and coalitions, I was able to get some fairly high-powered speakers from other organizations, you know, to come. So it ended up a much bigger deal than they ever expected it to be. For example, Al Sharpton spoke. And this is the old Al Sharpton when he weighed 350 pounds and was probably more controversial then. We basically took over Broadway south of Canal Street, had a very good rally. A couple of us were arrested for civil disobedience kind of things. I got arrested. I got handcuffed to Sharpton. which increased my street cred tremendously. Of course, it's still shut down. You know, I mean, we didn't save it. But because I think of the work we did, the NAACP ended up getting involved in that and ended up, and most of the operators ended up getting hired. A lot of them ended up getting hired at New York Telephone. So the ones who, a lot of people were able to keep their jobs.
Do you know what year this was or about
around
when?
Around 83, 84.
And prior, you mentioned something about an operator walkout.
I think that was nationwide, wasn't it? Job pressures today?
Oh, 79.
That was mm-hmm. what? But our operators in that building, they were wonderful. They were a very militant group. The president, the vice president for operator services at the time, I just blanked out on her name. There was one who was actually on bargaining, I think. I just can't remember her name. But the one subsequent to her, Andrea Lupo, who was a bell buster, ended up becoming a Comtech. I think she was the main leader of the walkout. It was very successful, and the techs came up and supported the operators. One advantage to where my local is that the Long Lines building, about three blocks from my office, was the international headquarters. Before they moved to Basking Ridge, it was the headquarters for AT&T. It's a beautiful historic building.
What's the address?
It was 32 Avenue the Americas, and that's where the operators were. And so you could really make a thing, you know, by marching around that building. So they walked out and refused to go back in. And that's when Gary locked himself in the bathroom. And I would feel bad about talking about him, except he became a manager. Chet became a manager. Several of the old officers ended up becoming managers for various reasons. But
you mentioned an operator who became a Comtech.
Yeah.
When AT&T, in your experience, when AT&T was trying to hire women into Comtech, was it mostly off the street, or was it promoting women from operators and service reps?
I think it was mostly. It was mostly off the street, but there were some that promoted. She got promoted a couple of years later. After the office closed, she would have lost her job. She didn't want to go to New York Tel. I should probably talk about that a little bit too.
Sure, go ahead.
So far back, this is going to take all day.
Okay.
When she lost her job as an operator, she ended up taking the test and passing it and becoming a communications technician. At the time of divestiture, a lot of us, they gave us a choice. Do we want to stay with AT&T, or did we want to go to New York Tel? Because the kind of work they were doing in my office, since we tested local circuits, they decided under the agreement that they could either, it could go either way. We could go to, and I the only reason I chose to stay with AT&T is that I didn't want to go into the Verizon local. I didn't want to go into 1101. It was a very big local. We would have been they had very few, they had no women in leadership. Very few women shop stewards even. So I decided that if I really wanted to do the union work that I would love doing, I would stay where I was.
And did most of the Comtechs stay or go?
A bunch of them. We didn't have, not the whole, there was only a certain number in the office who could go. I'd say, I would say most of the people who had a choice went, you know, and the fact is they didn't get that, you know, when we went through all those layoffs and stuff, they didn't go through the layoffs, and some of them, you know, retired with that 7-7 deal. And one of my best friends who actually ran for Secretary Treasurer the term before I did ended up going and actually ended up suing 9X for sex discrimination and winning. But I decided to stay.
So I think we're ready to jump into your union office work. Jeff, did you have any questions up till this point?
No, keep going. This is wonderful. I'm really enjoying this. It makes me wish we had these discussions years ago, finding out more about people and their backgrounds.
Okay. Yeah, it's almost like when you read people's obituaries.
Yeah, exactly. Except
like,
we're still here.
I didn't know that about them.
So we can have this before we have to write an obituary. We'll have it so we know what to write. Okay, so talk about getting elected union office.
Yeah, my first office that I ran for was Secretary Treasurer. And the previous Secretary Treasurer had been there, and she was a good woman. You know, I mean, I had, you know, but she'd been there for 20 years. She wasn't going to do anything new or different. Her name was Pat Meckel. Wonderful person. Her life was with it was the union. She had no other life outside the union. But I just really felt that I certainly wasn't ready to run for president, and I really felt that I wanted to run for local office. I ran Bob Swanson. I said the guy who was shop steward of my local, who ended up becoming my secretary treasurer. He was the head of the election committee. I ran. I won by 250 votes. And after the election, she challenged the election that the list she provided, that she discovered that the list she provided were wrong by 300 votes. She didn't have good addresses. The election committee had no choice but to agree with her. So I stupidly kept appealing it, right? I appealed it to the board. They rejected it. My appeal. I appealed it to the membership. They accepted my they found in my favor at a membership meeting. Then Pat, and it ended up going to Morty, who was the vice president of District 1 at the time. And he said, Laura, you know, I know this is crazy, but I have to rule in favor of Pat, because if it was 300 bad votes for whatever the reason, 300 people didn't get ballots for whatever reason, and you won by 250, then you have to accept that. So I reran, and I won by 700 votes because people were so furious about the waste of time and money. So I missed like the first 6 months of my term because the leadership stayed the same until. So that was upsetting.
What year was this?
This was 1984.
And you mentioned addresses for members. So is this mail-in ballot?
Yes, we had a mail-in.
Okay. So yeah. Secretary Treasurer in 1984. And one other small question. You mentioned Pat was the Secretary Treasurer. Was that typical that the males were the presidents and the women were Secretary Treasurers?
Yes, that was very typical. And also at that point, the local was big enough that all these people were full-time. So they were all full time at the local office, and during that time, I guess we had there was a strike in 84, right? 83. So that was her last one, and then there was another strike in 86. And to tell you the truth, I can't remember if that was the strike that only went 28 days, so that people didn't get the strike benefits or not.
Jeff, do you remember?
I'm terrible with years.
Yeah, me too. I think there was one
year
that we
need Cohen here to do that kind of stuff.
I mean, Nick remembered me handing out checks and that I was good at it, and that's one of the things that made me well. But I tell you the truth, I don't remember it. But we did do some. I know a lot of stuff. We had the best T-shirts because I designed great T-shirts. We did a lot of things. I don't know, that might have been the Oncola one too.
So the what?
The Oncola, that's when we had cost of living, and then they signed an agreement that said that, that sort of put it on hold unless such and such happened. And I know my local vigorously pushed to not sign, agree to the contract, and the slogan was "Don't drink the Oncola," and we did a big campaign around that.
Getting rid of the cost of living adjustment.
Not agreeing automatic to the contract because it got rid of the cost of living.
Okay.
So that was, a good thing that we did during that time. But the main thing that happened during those years is that the person who ran for president, Jim Pratt, had been president before and had been defeated and had come back. He was terrible. I mean, he was a wonderful, nice guy, but he was a gambler. He was addicted to gambling, and he just didn't do a whole lot. So I ran against him.
This is what year?
For the 86 election, I ran against him, and I had a slate, which a really good slate. I was ran for president. Ron Tyree ran for vice president. Bob Swanson, who had been my original shop steward and became one of my best friends, who actually was a Reagan supporter when I first met him, but stopped that pretty quickly. So we had a wonderful slate, and it was an unusual slate in that it was very multiracial. And it wasn't, people said, well, did you do that on purpose to make sure you had one black and one woman and one did? And it wasn't that. It was that I really think I took the best people for the job. And we had a wonderful slate. And all of us won on the first, I think all of us won on the first ballot. And we had a terrific executive board, and we were able to do a lot of things. One thing that I did is I insisted that everybody go back to work. The local wasn't that, had gotten smaller. And as I said, there's no reason we can't all at least work a day or two a week. And I just thought that was very important for the officers to be on the job so that they had to take the same shit that the shop stewards got. because there was always this, in every local, there was some discord between the people on the shop floor and the local leadership. They would say, well, they're not doing it, or they're not leading enough, or they don't understand. So I thought it was very important for people to keep working. So that was the first thing I did.
And you kept working?
I would work like one day a week, but at least it was enough that I had to show my face in the in the office. So that was an important thing I did. Another important thing I did is I kept, the local spirit kept coming out, and I always had a column in the local spirit so people knew what I was, some important things. And actually I won a newspaper award for an article I wrote called Mother Jones, Not Dow Jones. And it was an art, and this is just sort of typical of the kind of issues we tried to take on, is that I took, that was the time when the company was offering a lot of stock options, and if you worked a certain number of hours, you got stock, and people were always asking about the stock and the options and what should we do. And I basically said, it's not the union's job to give you stock advice. And in fact, I believe that a lot of those would try to split the loyalty of the members away from the union, because they would say, well, you can't go on strike. What's that going to do to your stock price? And you have all these savings, in stock. And, it was really, I think, a way to discourage militancy. And I wrote an article about it, and it ended up being reprinted a lot of places, and I won a newspaper award for it. But the most important thing in terms of what I did, I think, I had a daily tape, which was a number that people could call, and I would just talk for a minute, 3 minutes, depending on what the issues were, about stuff going on the local, stuff going on with the international, and stuff going on in the industry as a whole. And it really became something that people all over the country would listen to. In fact, we had to get a better system because people all over the country, in fact, some of the other local presidents, you know, sort of resented it because they said, well, my members are calling your tape and they're not calling my tape, you know. But I think that was real important in terms of not just increasing sort of general knowledge and militancy, but, you know, get people around the country knew who I was. And I, you know, and it's like a diary, actually. I mean, I gave a bunch of them to NYU, I think, because if you read them over time, it was almost every day. If I didn't do it, people would call me up and say, where's the tape? But it almost became a diary of the work that we were doing. And we really went out of our way to be a militant local.
What did that mean?
Well, as I said, we were near AT&T headquarters. So we would set up a picket line and leaflet whenever the board of directors came. We had Bob Allen once called us dinosaurs.
Bob Allen, CEO.
Bob Allen was the CEO of AT&T. He called us dinosaurs. So there was a balloon store down the block from the local office, and we got these big dinosaur blow-up dolls, and we marched in front of, you know, and we did that.
So you had fun as well.
We had fun, but we also were very, you know, we did a lot of grievances and won a lot of grievances, but we also did a lot of stuff. We did the shareholders meetings, because a lot of times the shareholders meetings, they would do them at Radio City Music Hall. I think one of the first locals that really took the shareholders meetings seriously of going to shareholders meetings. In fact, the company threatened to arrest us. They used to do a lot more at the shareholders meetings. They would like have a family night the night before, you know, where the families could come in and see stuff and get stuff. The company security threatened to arrest me at one of the shareholders meetings. We were just outside. They said we were blocking the sidewalk or something. And I said, please. You know, and I put my hands up, please arrest me. There's nothing you could do better to get me elected again than get me arrested at a shareholders meeting. You know, this is like fine. And of course they didn't. We did the Bob Allen thing, which the national leadership was not in favor of because they were always trying to, I think, have a good relationship with the CEO. But we did the Stop Allen. We had Stop Allen buttons. We organized a demonstration at Bob Allen's house when the layoffs really started heavily in 1991, which most of the East Coast locals ended up joining us on. He wasn't there that day, but we went anyway. And we leafleted his neighbors. We said, we're sorry to disrupt your Sunday, but you should know that the actions that Bob Allen, your neighbor, is taking is impacting our families in a much worse way, you know, because of the layoffs.
Did this kind of militancy create any tensions within the local?
Never within the local. Within the international.
Talk about that.
Not within the local. No, I think I was always very critical that I didn't think that they were that the international was militant enough against around the layoffs and against Bob Allen, and you know they were always seemed to be trying to play both sides a little bit of wanting to fight things, but on the other hand not pissing the leadership, the executives off too much. And that was not something that as a local president I worried about. I felt like we just had to do every single thing we could to try to fight the layoffs. And I'm not saying that my worked, you know, my local ended up with 350 people in it. But you know, we never felt like we didn't do everything we could do.
350 people
when I finally ended up coming on staff.
So that would have been what year?
Because of layoffs, 2007.
So the biggest,
keep going. I just want to mention one other thing that I think we did that was very important, which was in 1991, which was right in the middle of the layoffs. There was a huge outage that affected the whole East Coast, and they had to down airplanes. They had to take airplanes down because the what is called the air control system was down, and it was a major, major thing. And Nacho, who was the vice president at that point for operator services, I think. What was his first name? Nacho?
Joe, wasn't it?
Joe Nacho stood on the steps of Thomas Street and blamed it on the technicians. So we did a thing and found it out that, first of all, the people in charge of this particular switch that had gone down that had caused the problem, that the switch that happened, was on a floor that the alarm system that would show that there was a problem with it was on a floor that had been vacated because there had been so many layoffs. So nobody had even saw the fact that there was a flashing light. The guys who would have been in charge of fixing it very few of them left, and they were all had been sent to another building for some kind of class. So we basically showed a whole pattern of things that led up to it that could be tied to the layoffs, and none of which could be tied to technician error. So we made a statement to the newspaper. We did a big deal, and we ended up having three of my members and myself on Frontline, which I think was the name of it. It was a program on public radio where we talked.
Radio or TV?
On public TV, where we talked about what the real cause of it was and that the cause of it was the layoffs. We did a subway campaign. We had, and this, the Candace, the National Union helped me with the design of this thing.
Candace Johnson.
Yeah, we did a subway poster that we put all over the subways. That was it looked like the handle of a telephone, but it was a bone. And it said, AT&T has cut its workforce to the bone. Stop the outages now, something like that. And we put those all over the subways. So, it did change some things because the Jim Carroll, who was in charge of the network at the time, ended up, which was a national position, ended up coming and spending a whole day with my shop stewards.
Jim Carroll from CWA.
No, Jim. Oh no, no, he was.
I was thinking of a different Carroll. Okay. Jim Carroll was head of AT&T's network,
the whole network, mm-hmm. And he ended up spending a whole day with my shop stewards and walking around, and I really think. My local was really did not have, for a few years there, I think because of that, did not have as many layoffs as at least within for the guys who worked in the people who worked in the network, at least, because we took that action.
That's a powerful, powerful story. You mentioned that 91 was a time of a lot of layoffs. Had there been Nixon cuts up until that point?
Yeah, I think there had been, small layoffs and consolidations, but I'm trying to remember. I think 91 was really the time that we got hit heavy, and it was someone's layoffs, some was that decided since our work was on a test board. And that work became more and more automated over the years. So instead of doing things on a test board, a lot of the testing was done on computers. So they could form these sort of mega centers where they could do testing. And they decided that the mega centers for a lot of the testing were going to be in Atlanta, Right to Work, and Denver, Right to Work.
Right to Work in Colorado?
I think so, wasn't it? Was Denver Right to Work?
That was where the fight was, but yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of work got moved. So some people got transferred. A lot of people ended up having to take transfers different places and stuff. So we had big layoffs, but we also had a lot of people transferring. Some of it was technological, but a lot of it really had to do with the fact that they were moving moving work away. So that was the biggest, that was sort of a really big hit to local. Now, over the years, then, you know, what there became a time in AT&T when there were layoffs every few months, you know, but that was the big year for us where we really got killed.
Let's keep on with the local union and the relationship with the international and with the district. Talk about the ad hoc.
Okay. The ad hoc was a group that got together before I was president of people who I believe the reason they really got started is at the time of divestiture, the Long Lines presidents felt like they weren't gonna that they didn't have enough of us. They were losing power, right? You know, the AT&T Long Lines group was one of the earliest groups in the union. You know, my local was the first local in New York City. You know, the Long Lines local, and it was formed in they started organizing 35 or something when we became CWA. We were local number one, right? You know, so I think there was a lot of fear among the Long Lines presidents that they would not, you know, be recognized very much anymore. So that they felt the need to gather as a group. And it was a lot in the beginning, I think it was a lot of just information sharing, you know, because people didn't feel like they were getting enough information out of the national office, you know, so they would share information about grievances or talk about arbitration cases that they won or arbitration cases that they wanted to get fought that couldn't get fought. So it was really that kind of thing. They would do a little bit of, you know, planning what, you know, things that they might try to, what they should support at conventions, things like that. They were supposed to be, they weren't like supporting one candidate over another or something like that, but they were just trying to get their voices heard. It was at that time, it was mainly men. There were a few locals in it that were operator services, AT&T operator services local, so there were some women in it. I think Lois Grimes was already, I don't know if she might have been there by the time I started. But they changed over the years several times. But when I started going, you know, I really felt like they were putting me through the ringer, right? Because I was very new. I was a local president. I was a woman, you know. I remember that my first meeting, they took me to a restaurant that they used to like to go to that was like all hunting, you know, had picked dead animals all over the walls, and they ordered me Rocky Mountain oysters. I had no idea what they were, you know, and I ate one, and they said, you know what you're eating? It's the balls of a cow, right?
I had no idea.
That's what it is. You know, and I guess they thought that I was going to go out, you know, start screaming or something. And I said, oh, really? And I took my knife and I stabbed one of them and I ate it, you know. But it, you know, they gave me a hard time at the beginning. But over time, I became very close friends with a lot of them. And many years later, I ended up becoming a chair of the ad hoc. But I think, again, what I tried to do with the ad hoc was to try to get it to take more militant positions, you know, make more demands on the international. I wrote a very early resolution on the need for mobilization, you know, for mobilization activities. I have it somewhere. I can't remember what year that was, maybe 86 or 87. So, I mean, here I had just become local president, and I was trying to get them to support this resolution, because at that point it was already clear that we weren't going to be going on strike very much, and I really felt, you know, we had to do a lot more militant stuff on the job, and the ad hoc ended up supporting the resolution.
A resolution
for the C&T meeting. For the
community. Talk about C&T, what that is.
C&T is basically the part of the, I mean, it's, I think it started out mainly AT&T. It's an office of the National Union that handled basically AT&T but not the local companies, which was why when the split off happened, instead of us being one big group, all the local companies were represented by the districts. The only thing that TNT represented at that point was AT&T Long Lines, what had been AT&T Long Lines, Western Electric, the national units, Western Electric, which was a national unit, that eventually became Lucent. You know, eventually, as things split off, you know, it eventually handled the VIA. Every split off caused more stuff to either be taken out of that office or moved into that office, depending on what. And originally, when it first started, it was not an office with a vice president. It had a director that reported to the president. You know, I know there was some contention about, I think Fred Fish, actually somebody from my local, one of the early presidents of my local was the director for a short time. His name was George Myerskoff. And then I can't remember who all of them were, but Fred Fisher was one of them. And then Jim Irvine, I think was it, I don't know if he was, by the time he took the office, if he was, it was already, he was a vice president or he was still a director in the beginning, but he was
still a director. He was Long Lines director. He defeated Beeman Pearson,
Beeman,
who had been the Long Lines director prior to that. And it was under Jim and Ron Allen that they finally created, along with the public sector vice president slots for those jobs.
Did you say Jim Allen or Ron Allen?
Jim Irvine and Ron Allen.
Well, Ron Allen was in charge of sort of the Lucent piece of it. Jim was in charge of the AT&T piece of it. I guess when it got combined, right, Ron sort of stepped aside, let Jim be the vice president, and he stayed. He was his assistant in charge of that.
So you had a lot of tensions with that office.
Yeah, I mean, they started. In fact, the first convention I ever went to, and I don't even think I was there as a delegate. I went there because my newspaper was going to get, Local Spirit was getting an award, and it was in Philadelphia, so the Chet let me go to pick up my award. They agreed to these, what was called alpha titles, which was a low level, the lowest level job we had, a title for what had been billing workers. The company had threatened to move their billing either to an outside contractor or give some of it to the local companies. Jim decided, was told that if he accepted this very limited title, it would bring 11,000 jobs, and he signed off on it. There was people, it was like a, he announced it after, right after he got elected. There was people who were screaming and yelling and, you know, jumping on tables. It was quite an interesting first meeting for me.
This was at the national convention.
This was at a convention. It happened. He had made the announcement at a convention. So that was my first experience with him. But then we'd had conflicts over the years over, you know, what they would arbitrate, what they wouldn't arbitrate. And in general, the fact that I thought they were being too conciliatory to the company and to Bob Allen, you know, over the years. So I had a lot of disagreements.
Talk about the famous convention where you unrolled the long, long list of steps.
Yeah. First of all, on that, I want to set the record straight on something. That was Nick's idea.
Nick Unger,
Nick Unger, my husband. You know, I've gotten credit for this for so many years, and I always tell people this wasn't Nick's idea.
But you did it.
Oh, I did it. I mean, I'm absolutely proud of the fact that I did it. I don't think anything like that had ever been done before. But just to begin at the beginning, there was a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with the national office because we would bargain contracts, and whether we hated them or liked them or hated them, we knew what they were. And then we would go in and argue grievances, and they'd say, no, you know, the national office signed a stip on that.
A stipulation,
which means that it's an agreement that they do outside of the contract, but carries the weight of an agreement with the company. And it just happened too often. You know, you'd go and try to argue something, and they'd say, no, you can't grieve that because we signed a stipulation. We discussed it a lot at the ad hoc. Something needed to be done. So I wrote a constitutional amendment that basically, now we had elected bargainers at the time. The national parts of the agreement were bargained at that point by the national union staff vice presidents. Then we had our elected bargaining committee. So I put forth a resolution that said that if before the before anyone could sign a stipulation that it made a change or addition to the contract, they had to consult the elected bargaining committee.
Just consult,
which was probably a mistake on my part. I should have said get the approval of, but I didn't know we'd get as much support as it did. Now, this was absolutely opposed.
And what year is this?
By the National Union. I believe it was 1998, something around there, 97, 98. I met with the Constitution Committee. I mean, there was a story going around that I had agreed to withdraw it once because the executive board decided to do some kind of wishy-washy. They took a position, the executive board, that they would try to consult the bargaining committee, something like that. I didn't think that that was enough. I wanted it in the Constitution. I was told that I agreed to that, and I had never, that I agreed, absolutely never happened. Never happened. I had one meeting with the whole Constitution Committee and told them that I wasn't satisfied with that and that I was going to put it on the floor. The way the CWA conventions work is if the Constitution Committee doesn't agree to your resolution, you need a higher percentage to get it. You can still put it onto the floor of the convention, but you had to have a higher percentage of the delegates supporting it. So when they announced that they weren't going to put it on the at the convention, I went to speak. And what I had done is I had taken, people again thought this was computer paper that I unrolled. I had my children up 3 days before taking every stipulation, and there were 87 of them, and taped them together. And
Child labor.
My kids loved doing union work and still do. The night before we got to convention, the people in the ad hoc and particularly my secretary treasurer, Bob Swanson, who was 6'5", I told him to go find all the tallest people in the convention, and because we're going to unroll this thing and we need it high up. So he went out and did that. Found about 20 people to help. And so I went on the convention floor, and as I was speaking in favor of the resolution, I held up this roll, and it got rolled. It was in Los Angeles, I believe, and the roll went from the motions mic all the way to the back of the convention, all the way to the back. And people were like running up, because I remember this one guy, Glenn Hamm, he was small, and he was like, He was jumping up trying to hold on to it, and people just loved it. And we had this huge standing ovation, and you know, there were a few speakers against, but generally it won by a huge percentage. And
which meant that you had to get the non-AT&T delegates who did not work for AT&T, right, or represent folks at AT&T, yeah, behind this.
Yeah, so even though it was something that was clearly a problem, I think people generally felt very possessive of their bargaining teams, you know, that they were, that they felt that, they elect their bargaining teams, and it was bad enough at that point that we didn't have any seat yet at the national table. They eventually put one person, one elected member at the national table. But I think people wanted their bargaining teams to have power, you know, a little bit more power. And the fact is, it really didn't give them a lot more power. Basically, in some places it became a very sort of pro forma kind of thing. We want to do this and we want to do that, and they would tell the bargaining committees. But the fact is, I have to give Jim credit. He did, Jim Irvine, credit, because once we passed it, he did, if there was any kind of thing that needed to be changed, he did get he or one of his assistants got the team on the phone and we talked about it. And if we had strong objections, he did listen to them. But it was a big deal. And I've gotten called over the years, to consult, with the legal department and other, about what was its original intention and what did it mean. And, I always said, I think I was always afraid that would be the highlight of my career with AT&T, but it really was fairly special. And I think after that, it became not that more usual for, I think a couple of years later when the operators came in with masks, people to try to do, which I should say something about CWA conventions. I mean, my husband was in other unions and where the conventions were absolutely orchestrated. Absolutely nothing happened on the floor of those conventions unless it was absolutely planned in advance. Nothing unexpected had happened. And the CWA conventions, aside from being yearly, which was unusual, were quite democratic, I think, in the way they were run, and that people could do things. The company was sitting up in the balcony, and everybody stood up and shame on you, shame on you. There were things happened on the convention floor that were good and unexpected. And
as a delegate, I know that you've talked with me about what it was like to be a delegate and the lobbying and maneuvering.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was elected to national bargaining in 1992. Two of the people on that were Annie Crump and Donna Conroy, who are the two of the smartest, most militant women I've ever met. and they, along with Joanne Bell and a couple of other people, really knew how to work the convention. And when I mean work the convention, I mean that they scrutinized the financial report, so that they could ask good questions. They would organize behind the scenes to get certain things passed and not passed, and to get people to line up and not to speak on things. So they really sort of schooled me a lot in how to do some of this stuff. So we really, I think, use the convention in good, good ways. I mean, I get very angry the last few conventions I've been to because it just seems that people aren't willing to put in the work, because you need to put in the work. You need to write your resolutions. You need to, read the financial report and figure out if there's anything you should ask. You need to do, there's things you need to do if you really want to make it a democratic convention. And I don't get the feeling now that there's a group of people out there who do that. The ad hoc started paying more attention. We had a person assigned to each district in case we needed to get ourselves together. We insisted on a table of our own, that the TNT group had that. Instead of sitting with the districts, most of us sat at that table, but we always tried to make sure a few people stayed in each district so that we could talk to people in the districts. So we really paid attention to trying to get as much out of the conventions as we could. And I really get the feeling that that's really gone by the wayside.
Very briefly, you said people would line up.
Right.
Somebody who hasn't been to a convention, what does that mean?
There's different mics. There's the motions mic, where you can make a motion. There's a for mic, if you're for something. There's an against mic, if you want to speak against. And then there's a questions mic, which can be very useful too. But generally, they'll only allow a couple of speakers for and a couple of speakers against. But over time, it got to a thing where it was almost like they were almost like demonstrations. So if you wanted to show that you had a lot of support, you would get, even though you knew you wouldn't have to speak, make sure that the people who really wanted to speak were in the front. and then other people would line up. So there were some times when the people would be lined up all around the whole side of the convention, you know, on the for mic or the against mic. And it was a way to kind of judge your strength. But the other thing about it is, I mean, sometimes it would get confusing because somebody would make an amendment and you'd have to run from the for mic to the against mic. So it gets confusing, but it also makes it very sort of visual how much support you have and how much you don't.
So we have big changes at AT&T and in the industry going on during the time when you're a local president. Briefly, what's going on?
Well, since I started, I mean, the main thing that was going on was layoffs. But I mean, a lot of it had to do with, you know, the way the company organized itself into business units and cost units, and it was all very. It was part of it is this group called McKinsey, which is an infamous consulting firm, who was doing a lot of the consulting with them about how to consolidate and cut costs and things like that. So in every sort of aspect of our lives, they were changing the way we do the work. So the work was getting much more automated, which meant that people didn't get trained at all in the way they used to. You know, people used to go through 6 months of training, now we're going through weeks of training. You know, the call center stuff was going on where they were consolidating and exporting jobs to call centers. AT&T was trying to use more subcontractors. It was pretty much a bloodbath.
So job security becomes a major issue.
Job security was a major issue. That's when they started chipping away at people's medical benefits. That became a big issue. What they did to our pensions became a big issue. They moved, you know, their company moving from a traditional pension plan to these cash balance accounts, which there was a tremendous amount of controversy over. You know, so in every way, they chipped away. And, you know, it wasn't so much, it was big, a lot of big things, but it was also small things too. Like they would move offices from one spot to another so they could, we had some offices that were 37 and a half hours and some offices that were 40 hours. And they would move offices just like a few blocks away to try to change their hours from 37 and a half hours to 40 hours. I mean, they just, so in every sense, they were chipping away at both things locally and obviously on a big scale. Could I tell a quick story?
Of course.
So we represented clerical workers at the headquarters building that's now the Sony building on in New York City. AT&T ended up selling it. And they were a 37 and a half hour office. They were moving them into a building that was owned by Prudential downtown and told them that they were going to change the office to 40 hours. The contract was fairly clear that they could do it. You know, and I went to Irvine and I tried to arbitrate it. They said, no, can't arbitrate. Jerry Clem, you can't arbitrate it. You can't arbitrate it. It's been settled. They've done this before. So I wrote a leaflet that said to the other tenants of this building, the Prudential building, make sure you start locking up your pocketbooks because AT&T is moving into the building. And if they're willing to steal 2.5 hours pay from their own clerical workers, from their own clerical workers, imagine what they'll do to strangers. So I wrote the leaflet and I sent it to Diane Bradley.
Who's Diane Bradley?
Who's the head of labor relations at AT&T. And it was a Tuesday. And I said, this is going to be distributed all over that building on Thursday. And she came back on Wednesday and they left them. They left them in 37 and a half hours. And I never even had to, I made one copy of the leaflet. I never even had to print the leaflet.
That's a great story. Wonderful. Those are the kind of things that make you feel really good, right?
Yes, it was really good. But
Jeff, I am going to move into Workplace of the Future. So before I do you want to talk about, ask some questions of what we've
No, I'm
covered so
fine. I
far?
mean, this is time is flying by here. This is really great. I love
Yeah,
that
I have a
story.
class at 2 o'clock. But let me, I should back up. Just one thing that we didn't cover is that I was elected to the national bargaining team, you know, because I think of my work with the ad hoc and other things. I ran against somebody who was a really old friend of a lot of the old, you know, some of the leadership of the ad hoc. I mean, like C.H. Grizzle was one president of the biggest local Atlanta. Roy Jones, who was the president of the New Orleans local. Glenn Hamm was the president of
somewhere in Illinois.
Something in
Illinois.
Oak Brook.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they were all very close friends and had been out bargaining together many years.
All men?
Well, they were an operator services, you know, person who was generally a woman, and I believe even admin, which was clerical workers, that was CH's Grizzle seat. It was a man who had that seat.
So you were elected to represent a particular
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
Of
so there was a plant seat,
title.
There was an operator seat, there was an administrative seat. There was an at-large seat, you know, there were a few, but I didn't even have that many clerical workers at that point, and very few marketing workers. But one of the guys on the bargaining team who had that seat, people really wanted to get rid of him. Alcohol problem, you know, just something that people just didn't feel like he was carrying his weight. And people felt that I should run for bargaining, and the other seats were unbeatable. You know, I mean, CH was not going to be beaten, and Roy was should not have been beaten. So they basically decided that I was the only person who could take on that spot, even though it wasn't my area of expertise, really. But so I ran and won fairly handily, but it created some bitternesses that went on for years. You know. The president of one of the first of all, Roy supported me, Roy Jones, and that's fabulous, and took a lot of courage on his part because he really had to stand up against his friends. The president of the Syracuse local, John McCann, he supported me. So the people who really stepped up to do that really had to take some garbage from their longtime friends. But from that point on, I was on bargaining. So I was on in 92 in the marketing seat. And then as time went on, I moved, I think I mainly moved into the, I think I might have had the plant seat at one point or another, but I think I mainly moved into the at-large seat. So I was on bargaining, you know, basically every year as an elected bargainer until I went on staff in 2007, and then I was on bargaining as staff, which I did not like nearly as much as doing it. Because we had some very contentious bargainings at the time. There were people who felt that, you know, that the contract was signed over the heads of the bargaining committee the one year, and people we refused to sign it. And one of the members was just browbeaten into changing her vote so that it ended up going for ratification. But the year after that, and many of us refused. You know, and you had the power to do that. And that's the key thing about being a local president. As long as your members want you, it really gives you a tremendous amount of power, because you don't have to worry, you know, you don't have to, you can speak your mind, right? And you can do things that you would not normally be allowed to do. And as I said, you know, my members, I got elected. I never had opposition. Some of my board did, but I never had. And as I said, there was no local president before me that ever had that situation. It was so freeing, you know, being a local president, especially after I'd been on staff and I could compare the two. But I could compare them also with my family, because my husband was always staff. And he would get fired all the time. You know, he was constantly being, you know, told you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. You know, so I mean, he worked for a lot of different unions, and he was always, you know, if he wasn't fired, he was in trouble. So I really, and when my son decided to get involved in the trade union movement, you know, I really encouraged him to do what I did. You know, go in, become a worker, you know, work your way up. And he did not take that path, but, and he's doing okay. But because you're elected on bargaining, you know, and I always got reelected, even though people ran against me, I always got reelected. And it just, it made a real difference being an elected person rather than a staff person.
Let me ask you just a quick question back, dial back to this 37 and a half hour story that I love. Would a younger Laura Unger have distributed the leaflet first without calling Diane Bradley?
No.
Okay.
No, that was really the tactic. And I knew Diane Bradley enough. And she knew me well enough to know that I would pretty much do anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I had done a lot of stuff. We had done a lot, aside from being on bargaining together, we had done a lot of stuff and shared all those meetings and done some fairly outrageous things. So she had no doubt in the world that I would do it. And I thought once we handed it out, it was done. You know, they could either, it was too late. I was really just trying to, I wanted to stop it before it happened. And you know, once it was out there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a nuance there that I think some people don't get all the time. You know, they'll shoot first and then try and solve the problem.
No.
I think that's important.
I was pretty smart in those days.
Yeah.
Gotten less smart now, but workplace of the future.
There's a lot to ask about the various bargaining sessions, but let's start with workplace of the future. 92, it was bargained. What was it? What was your attitude about it? How did this, as a local president, what did you do?
I mean, this is another 2 hours. I mean, it's, you know, I always had very mixed feelings about it.
Explain what it is.
Okay, Workplace of the Future was a program that was agreed to with AT&T, and it was supposedly to give the union more input into decisions, that the company would share more information with the union, and the union would be part of these committees on a national level that hopefully would impact decisions of the company as a whole, and then as it got further and further down onto the shop floor would influence, you know, different things around the conditions of work. There had been a program before that called Quality Work Life, which my local had participated in somewhat. For about a year, they sent a lot of people to a lot of training, and we tried to do stuff on the shop floor. In fact, Bob Swanson, my secretary treasurer, was involved in it. Gary Whaley, the guy I mentioned to, was appointed by Chet to be a trainer. As the layoffs kept happening, the local decided at a membership meeting that we pushed to pull out of it. The day we pulled out of it, Gary Way became took a management job. So we had some experience with it before. But I think the problem was, you know, it was desperation. We had so many layoffs that I think even as skeptical as we were of it, and it was not a new thing in the labor movement. I mean, there had been programs very similar to it, the auto workers, you know, and I had done a lot of reading about it, you know, how the auto workers set up their training and did things. So there was experience which helped make me skeptical. But I think it was really a sense of desperation. You know, we have to figure, no matter what we were doing, the layoffs were continuing. We had no say. So let's give it a shot. So there was a big kickoff meeting. Robert Reich was there. The leadership of AT&T was there. The leadership of the CWA was there. You know, it was this big kickoff. There was a lot of opposition at that meeting. the illusion of inclusion was the big thing that came out of that meeting. And I agreed to be appointed to one of the national planning, or they call them business planning councils, you know, and I think we met maybe once a month or something like that.
Which one?
Pardon me?
Which business planning council?
It was business. There was a one for the network, and there was one for like business services, which included, they would had techs in it, and you know, customer service reps and things like. So I participated, and I think I really did. As a member of the planning council, I think I participated, you know, as well as possible, you know, because I was, you know, I knew what kind of questions to ask and things like that. But on the whole, I did my local, also set up some local committees. I ended up spending an inordinate amount of time on this. You know, it was set up in a way that the union got to pick all of the people who participated on a local level and also participated on the national level. You know, so it did give the union certain power on the job, you know, in terms of who we put on these committees and things like that. The local committees, I don't think, ever really panned out very much in terms of accomplishing much of anything in it. Then on a national level, we did accomplish one very good thing on our planning council, which was the creation of a higher level title. It happened to be that the manager, this guy Bill Stake, who was in charge of that business unit, was sort of willing to do more. And when they created this new title, involved the union in it. And in fact, we ended up with a title that was one of the highest titles that had been negotiated in years.
This was a title for the customer service reps,
right,
who were serving small business or medium business,
right,
customers.
So, you know, I can't say that there weren't some advances to it. On the other hand, I really think the union dropped the ball. I mean, one of the things I think that I read that the UAW had done is they had independent training for the union people on the committees. The company and AT&T decided to hire jointly. Well, there were two different things that were joint. One was a guy named Mike McAbee, who's like considers himself an expert in these kind of programs, who I think is awful. He slept through half the meetings. He was getting paid a fortune. But the other thing they decided was to involve Rutgers, and there were two people from Rutgers, Sue Sherman and Charles Heckscher, and they developed, you know, these joint training classes and things. You know, I thought that was the wrong way to go. I really think that we sent people into these meetings and, you know, with these company people who were like, you know, been there forever, had MFAs, had all these consultants working with them, had all this stuff to support. You know, as I said, McKinsey was involved in it up to their eyeballs, giving advice about layoffs and things like that. There was, you know, the union people, some of them went in and they were just overwhelmed by despite the fact that, you know, that we really tried to put good people on these, you know, they were good people. But they walk into these environments where they're so overwhelmed, they don't have the education to understand a lot of what the financials. They were sometimes captivated by their proximity to power. You know, they were wined and dined. I mean, the fact is we had, you know, we were given, you know, they served these lavish dinners sometimes. And I just think it was hard for people to really make very much of a contribution, a lot of people. And some of them were seduced. A bunch of them became management. You know, they would see who was good or not good and promote them. One of the guys on our business council took a promotion. One of the union people on it took a promotion. So I just think we just didn't do our job I mean, I don't know if we ever could have prepared people enough to really have much of an impact, because at some point the company decided it was not worth the little bit of labor peace it gave them, you know, and they were going to move ahead with all their layoffs anyway. But it was, I think it was a very difficult time, and I really did throw myself into it, probably too much. You know, I mean, I was constantly writing papers and giving speeches, and you know, the company, as you know, I had to, I felt like I spent half my time like educating management about unions. It was just so we finally, it finally fell apart, because AT&T just, it wasn't going to change anything in terms of AT&T's trajectory, and
And CWA formally fell, pulled
pulled
out.
out.
As a local president who was so involved in the Business Planning Council and the different activities at the local level, for you personally and for others of your peer local presidents, did it sap energy? Did it sap militancy? That's the traditional critique of
Yeah,
these
I think
programs.
it did.
Can you give
Yeah,
an example?
I mean, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I can't remember ever deciding not to do something because I was on a planning council. But on the other hand, as I said, I think there was a feeling of some hopelessness, you know, that everything else that we had tried wasn't really working that well anyway, you know. So that's how, I mean, my board was very militant board. You know, and they raised questions about why are we doing this? Should we, you know, you know. And I was constantly having to convince them of whatever little gains that we made, that you know, we should stick to it. But you know, so in a sense, I'm not sure if it was the workplace of the future that sapped our locals' militancy, or just the fact that we had sort of begun to run out of ideas, you know. Which, you know, it's like at some point you say, "We're, you know, we're losing, we're losing, we're losing, we're losing," you know. So,
The external forces were so big that you were
yep,
fighting a company in decline, struggling to find a business plan.
You know what I realized I forgot to talk about? That a fact that I ran against Irvine.
Let's hear about it. When
Well,
was there?
that's going to be very short, but it was small. At some point, I decided, you know, that somebody had to run against Jim Irvine, and some friends asked me to do it, right? So I did. It was 1999, and you know, on the one hand, I'm glad I did it. I think I was able to really. I mean, I think some of the critiques I wrote in my campaign literature, you know, were absolutely, absolutely on the money in terms of, you know, what I didn't think could be done and should be done. And it was an issue, me being a woman. You know, the installer, couple of the installer local guys who were also dissatisfied said, "Yeah, we understand what you're saying, but we don't think a woman could do this job." They actually told me that straight up. I think that was certainly part of it. On the other hand, you know, there's the power of the incumbency. You know, there were a couple of big locals. You know, there was one person who came crying to me afterwards, you know, saying she should have supported me. She was the big, very big local in Worthington, maybe.
Ohio.
I'm not sure it was that local. Maybe it was Minneapolis. But anyway, it was a, you know, who came to me afterwards, basically crying, said she was going to support me, but Jim had offered her something, you know, that she really wanted. And, you know, so there is a tremendous power to the incumbency. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, Jim was, a lot of people loved Jim. He was smart. He was well respected. You know, I'm not going to, you know, take away from the fact he wasn't like one of these slugs who didn't work hard. He worked hard. You know, I probably gained a little bit more respect for him once I got on staff and realized how hard it was to run an office like that. But so anyway, so I lost 2-1. I ran a great campaign. We had the best t-shirts.
What'd they say?
It was LU, let's unite, you know. It cost me about $10,000 of my own money, but got me first class plane tickets for a year because I had done so much flying around. I met a lot of local people around the country, and I'm not sorry I did it. The thing about it, though, is that Jim retired before the end of his term and appointed Ralph, and Ralph Mailey became vice president. And once I started to go know Ralph and work with Ralph and Mailey, he's just like militant, decent guy and never held a grudge, which is really unusual, I think, in the CWA sometimes. Never held a grudge of the fact that I ran against Jim. And eventually he's the one who put me on staff. But I think it was important that I did it. And I think it was important that we had that discussion in the CWA about some of the issues. And it probably did help, Jim think about maybe hopefully help people in that in the group to think about things a little differently. So.
Jeff, I'm going to stop again to see. We haven't talked in detail about many triennial bargaining, so I didn't know if there's anything you wanted to highlight from that, either you, Jeff, in questions or Laura, you.
Yeah.
No, let's just keep pressing on here. We still
I
have
mean, I'll
ground to
tell you,
cover.
my memory isn't great about, I have friends who can tell you in this year of bargaining, this happened. I mean, I can remember some highlights of things that happened, but, like the agreement up for the commission plan was just a horror as far as I was concerned when they
Talk a
decided on
little bit
having
about that.
a commission-based pay for one of the titles. And I was on the group I was one of the people bargained for it, and we fought and fought and fought and did not want it, did not want it, did not want it. It was one of the company's major goals for that bargaining. They sent the bargaining team home at one point and called us back after the national. Jim agreed to it with very few of the protections that we thought should have been in there.
This is an opportunity to mention a name of somebody who you mentored and worked closely with in the fight over that, and that's Mary Ellen Mazzeo.
Right.
Talk a little bit about your relationship with her and her leadership.
Well, she was the president of that local in Syracuse that whose previous president was one of the guys who came out supporting me. And she became the president of the Syracuse local and ended up running for marketing. She ended up with the marketing seat, not the year I had it, and then I think Keith Edwards had it, and then Mary Ellen had it. But she is like the leader of the sales rep commission people. She was also on the she also was one of my campaign leaders in my campaign, and my she Annie Crump and Donna Conroy were like the leaders of my campaign, and became one of the most respected local presidents in the whole country, I think, around both her work around the commission plan and trying to always make it better. And also she really pushed herself to gain expertise around pensions, so she became sort of the bargaining team pension expert. We were just always friends, but she said something to me when I told her I was going to do this, which is that I underestimated my impact on the next generation of women. She's not that much younger than me. She's like 4 or 5 years, but she came became president. There was a lot of local people who became women who became local presidents over the years, who when I started, I said at the ad hoc, there were only a few women local presidents, and they were mainly operators and sales people. Now there's, I would probably have, I don't know, a large number of local presidents from the AT&T group are now women, and I think it did have an impact. I was never like a mentor like Nick does, my husband does, where I don't like sit there and analyze people's performance and help them try to think about things in a different way, but I think I tried to lead by example, and it, according to Mary Ellen, it had a big impact on these women feeling like they could do more than they ever that they had before, and to think about things in different ways. So, and if she gives me any credit for that, then you know that probably be enough of an accomplishment, because she's fabulous. I mean, she retired a couple of years ago, but there are a few women that I'm proud that I had some influence on.
Any other names you want to mention?
Well, I mean, like something like Shari Wojtowicz, you know, I mean, she's a loose cannon and made all the same mistakes that I made. But on the other hand, you know, she's got a militant attitude to the company and is not afraid to speak her mind. Lynell Piercy. I mean, there's a few of them that, you know, it helped them, just like it helped me to have Annie and Donna, Annie Crump and Donna Conway. It helps to see examples of people who were, who stand up, you know. And
your decision to go on staff, talk about that.
Big mistake. No, I mean, it's interesting because, first of all, when Jim Irwin left and Ralph Maley became vice president, there were some people who encouraged me to run against him, because he came out of manufacturing. People were afraid that he didn't know AT&T, you know, the core AT&T that well. So Bill Bates, who was at that point the head of the ad hoc, we sat down, me and Ralph, and I told him, and I told him my concerns. And at that point, tell you the truth, I already liked Ralph. Because he handled a case, a huge case in my local, where they tried to take my 37 and a half hour off tour away from my tour. And I think I talked about this when I nominated him one year. He was just completely audacious. He asked for so much more than I would have, when he helped to bargain the solution to the thing. I mean, people were walking away with checks for $3,000, $5,000. I mean, it was incredible. So I had really gotten to respect Ralph over time. So when it came up, I really wasn't that interested in running against him. But I was concerned that 2002 bargaining was coming up, and I didn't think that I was worried about him, or what was going to happen. And so we worked out a deal. And that was that I would come down to Washington for a year before bargaining, and help prepare AT&T for it, you know, to come up with a mobilization plan, to reach out to every local to try to figure out what their strengths and weaknesses were, to do some corporate investigation, to do everything I could. So Ralph agreed to it. And I mean, that year cost me a fortune because they wouldn't pay for anything. So I paid my own transportation back and forth. I paid for an apartment, you know, which is not cheap in D.C. for it. And then it turned out that the people in his office were much less forgiving than Ralph was. And I think the staff union complained that I was doing bargaining at work. So they put me in the research department. And I did the work out of the research department. I did the work out of the research department, and was wonderful because I got to be friends with Debbie Goldman and Louise Novotny, and it was good. I think we did a lot of good work. The funny thing is though that we ended up extending the contract that year, and we ended up not having to. I mean, the company maybe could see that we were more prepared, but we did end up extending the contract that year, and we didn't actually go into a real, you know, fight over bargaining. But after that, from that point on, Ralph really wanted to get me on staff. And there were no openings in his office. I don't know if I want to get into this. He tried to get District 1 to hire me. And Larry and Mancino and I were not.
Larry was the vice president then.
Partially because I supported Jan Pierce. When Jan Pierce was running, because I think there was always a contentious relationship in general between the districts and the AT&T locals, because they were mostly beholden to the Verizons and the local company locals, you know this. Jeff. and Jan Pierce was always absolutely supportive of me when I had the demonstration against Bob Allen's house. He was there. He was a speaker. He helped me get people. He was always very supportive. So I supported Jan. Also, I don't want to get into this, but at some point along the line, they split our local. Right before I became president, they split our local, split the clerical workers in New Jersey away from our local. And Jan participated in that. He said if he had known that I was going to run for president, he wouldn't have done it. But the leadership in the local was so terrible at the time that they did it. So I didn't hold that against him. but Mancino did. Mancino held that against me that I think not both that I supported Jan. And so actually Ralph set up an interview with Larry Mancino. He asked me questions I thought were inappropriate, like why I didn't merge with 1101, the big Verizon local. He asked me why I supported Jan. He asked me a bunch of questions that I was respectful as I could be, but I answered honestly. He played a role in the bargaining where I felt he had strong-armed one of the CWA, one of the committee members, so I didn't take it. He complained to Ralph that I insulted him. Anyway, but Ralph, as I said, Ralph is, he was always very supportive of me, and when an opening arose in 2007, he appointed me to be on staff. And
this was now after SBC had bought AT&T.
I guess so.
Yes, that was in 2005. So it was a very different what you all were responsible for.
But one good thing is, aside from the fact that there's the grievance backlog in that office was just insane. I mean, that kind of stuff was a mess. But one of my first jobs he gave me, though, which was really fascinating, was the closing of Merrimack Valley. I negotiated the closing agreement for Merrimack Valley, and that was one of the biggest. That's a giant, used to be Western Electric plant up in Massachusetts, and it was the most depressing thing. I mean, by the time I got there, it was one of these factories that you look down, it's miles and miles and miles of machines, and there was just these empty floors with, signs up about safety and productivity on these empty floors. There were about 300 people left by the time I took it over, but we had to both negotiate a closing agreement and also settle all the outstanding grievances and stuff. And there was an interesting local president there. His name is Gary Nilsson, who had done a hunger strike. I don't know if you remember him. So that was a really fascinating learning experience. So that was, I felt like there were some things I accomplished, doing that.
What were you able to accomplish in that negotiation?
Well, we got people, a better termination settlement. We just got people a lot of benefits that extended beyond the closing of the place. But it was a closing agreement. It wasn't like we were going to change anything. I mean, this is a place that was so huge that when Kennedy was running, a president. I mean, it's the kind of people, politicians used to go there to talk to the people. It was huge, and it was just. But there were things that happened. The AT&T at that point was closing down all the Bell Labs, and I had to negotiate all that and make sure that people were given jobs in other places. And
Laura, does Bell Labs still exist?
It was AT&T Labs, they called it at the time. But they had an office in Holmdale, which is like a beautiful historic building, and there was one in Murray Hill. And there was another one, I can't remember where it was, that was already closed down. So by the time I got there, the only one that was left of the labs building was Holmdale. And we had to bargain. What we represented there were the maintenance workers, just the maintenance workers. The scientists were not. So I did a lot of work with Lucent. I ended up bargaining that contract, and I think we bargained a fabulous contract for Lucent. So I th actually my best work was with Lucent, I think, which was not which was not
and
my area of expertise
the plant closings were AT&T was moving offshore or Lucent, I guess, was moving offshore, or they were getting out of the competition was driving them out of the manufacturing of telecom equipment.
Well, I think when we closed Merrimack Valley, they had pretty much gotten out of manufacturing. And, you know, and Lucent was consolidating, you know, and look what happened. Lucent's gone. I mean, they got bought by Nokia, and AT&T just gave its Nokia contract. I mean, this is like, I don't know why there wasn't much of a deal about this. I mean, Nokia bought Lucent, and AT&T made most of the technological equipment for AT&T for the big changes in the networks, the 5G networks and stuff. And AT&T just signed a huge contract, I think, with Ericsson. So like this whole history that started with Western Electric that moved, you know. Also, they had installers nationwide who I represented, and we had to, the contract we bargained, the last contract, I mean, they basically got out of the installation business. They contracted out a lot of that work, and I mean, that last contract was just a strange, strange contract because we had to, you know, basically it was the overseeing of how the dissolution of the installation group was, and we did very well in terms of the guy's benefits, but it was still, you know, it was just a horror that the installers are like some of the oldest groups in AT&T and CWA and telecom. No. Anyway, so that was fine. What I hated about being on staff is this issue of editing. You know, it's like everything has to be run past somebody, right? You know, you can't say what you want, you can't write what you want, you can't. You know, I just felt like I had a bridle over my face. And I did not like that. And, you know, I mean, I worked with Ralph the best way I could. I was not that happy with the office, to tell you the truth. People in the office, they didn't like me particularly. I didn't, you know, because they still held a grudge. Some of them still held a grudge from the past, and they resented the fact that I had such a good relationship with Ralph. You know, I just found it really difficult. And I got to see how difficult it is to make changes, because unless you're willing to discipline people, which nobody seems to be willing to do, you know, I'm a good staff union member too, but I mean, the members deserved better. And I didn't feel like there was enough that could be done to fix things. And I felt that every day. And I felt it even more so when Ralph left and I became Billy's assistant, and you would think that that would give you more power to do what was right. And I never felt like I knew how to fix things.
Billy Bates, who became...
Bill Bates became. Mm. And in fact, Bill only stayed vice president for 2 years. He just finished out his term and didn't run. And everybody expected me to do it. You know, they said, well, here, finally, we're going to get Laura, right? And I said, no. I said, I was 66. I did not want to commit myself to working till I was 70. I didn't think it was right to run for the job if I wasn't going to stick to it. And, you know, against Nick would have wanted me to run for it, I think. But I just said, I put my foot down. I said, no, I'm not doing this. I don't think I could do enough in this office without me. And by that point, the office was hardly representing anybody anyway. It's gotten so, the size of the AT&T, the people that office represented in terms of actually represented them, was smaller than half than my local used to be, basically. So I just decided it was time to go.
And what year was it?
That was 2015.
Is there anything else in your notes that we haven't covered?
I mean, there are some international conferences and stuff. I don't think they're that important. That's it. I think we've
Jeff?
pretty much done.
You know, I've enjoyed all these. This may be the best one yet. It was really terrific. I really enjoyed sort of this trajectory, and I mean, I think it is key to understand, you know, that you create change by putting change makers in position to do that. So, I mean, you getting, you know, first elected as president of local, but then eventually coming on staff is, I think it's a testament to the union to say that, you know, we would bring people who had opposed us in the past into those roles because we recognize that they can be catalysts for change. First person I put on staff was Ann Crump. You know, and she had been, you know, always a radical within our district, but it was, you know, this notion of getting people in there that could really make things happen. So thanks for doing this. This is really terrific.
I mean, the thing I would say is that I think was important is the experience that I gained early on in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, going through that whole period of my life, I think gave me a, first of all, it made, you know, before anybody in the CWA started talking about coalition building, I mean, that's what I understood, first of all, that that's what you had to do. You always had to work with, you know, with other groups. And also just having a broader political perspective and, you know, even internationally understanding what was going on to the industry nationwide. So I think all of that was very important. I mean, one short story, if you don't mind 2 minutes.
It's your time. She's
AT&T
just keeping me on track.
I had a building at 53rd Street and 10th Avenue, which was in the middle of the red light district in New York. I mean, really, just prostitutes all over the streets. AT&T had a slogan to try to get people to took phone calls to refer people to the right place, and it was called Easy to Do Business With, and Easy
Easy
to
to
Do
do
Business
business with.
With, and everybody got this little note card that said that had all the phone numbers that for everybody would need to refer people to the right place, so they weren't sending people all over the world. AT&T put out a T-shirt that said, "I'm easy," and wanted people to wear them. So of course, my women workers, particularly the one, we all reacted badly, but particularly the ones on 10th Avenue, you know, were getting all kinds of shit if they wore the T-shirt. So I immediately, you know, put out a call to Coalition of Labor Union Women, to National Organization of Women, you know, to protest that, and I ended up with an apology from AT&T. AT&T had this famous cover to their magazine called Focus, and they were showing how well they do all over the world. And there was a cartoon, and the cartoon for Africa was a monkey. And remember that? And I immediately knew who to reach out to, you know, which civil rights organizations. So, you know, I think having that background really did help me, and sort of a much, you know, a worldview really helped me a lot. On the other hand, I think part of my strength was I understood how far to push that. You know, I think one of the reasons Jan Pierce lost is he set, tended to sometimes do some radical political things that the people that he didn't bring the locals with him to understand. You know, in fact, we had a discussion once on at an executive board meeting about some kind of something was going on in El Salvador, and you know, we were trying to just we had contributed some money. You know, it was against the Honduras labor union people in jail. Something had gone on, and one of my members raised his hand and said, "Who the hell is this El Salvador?" You know, and it was clear to me that it was you know, that I was making that mistake. You know, you have to. I think the key to doing this work well is having that broad view, bringing your members along with you. And, you know, I love them, my members, and they, you know, we have this, I still go see them once a month if I can. And it's also being absolutely open and honest about what your aims are. And I think even when, you know, I was fighting against Irvine and raising stuff at the convention, I don't think I ever did it in a nasty, underhanded kind of way. I think the issue of being open about who you are and being principled about the way you do it is really the key to doing this work well.
It's a good ending, but I want one more thing on tape, and that's your relationship with the guys in your local.
I love them. I love them. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I just, I, you know, there's, you know, every local has a group that you just know that will always have your back, you know, and you know, a lot of us, most of them are old, a little bit older than me, but they all retired, and we still get, they have a group called the Old Farts, which was always called the Old Farts, but then somebody figured out it could stand for Federation of AT&T Retired Technicians, and they meet at a bar once a month, and I try to go up, you know, when I can. I'm actually going up this month. I try to go up when I can, but we really did have a relationship, not where, you know, it was both political and personal, where they would felt like I would do anything for them and they would do anything for me. And that's very unusual, I think. You know, I just, so that's one of the reasons I love being local president. I just loved, not every member, you know, I have a lot of terrible members, but actually we went over a lot of people who had quit the union because they had been, had bad experiences with previous local leadership, and some of them became my shop stewards, you know, so it's,
I didn't ask this because this isn't always at the foremost of your mind, but I, one last question. How did you combine working, being active in the union, and raising two kids?
Well, I mean, partly it was because the kids were always involved. I mean, Nick, we didn't have any money. I don't know how he's, you know, he asked me how we paid our bills. I have no idea. You know, first of all, Nick has got a husband who, you know, when I had to start work at 7 o'clock in the morning, he was the one who took Katie to the baby, you know, babysitter. We lived in a neighborhood where the neighborhood women were our babysitters, you know, for $50 a week or $30 a week. Nick always, we never had an issue, Nick and I, between who did what. You know, Nick, all the neighborhood women knew Nick because he did the laundry at the laundromat, you know. But I think the main thing is that they were always involved, my children. You know, it's like it, I didn't have to, we didn't have to leave them at home for a meeting. You know, if one of us couldn't be there, you know, they were there. The kids came with me. And, you know, I have pictures of David on a picket line with the local T-shirt hitting his feet, you know. And they were both on the picket lines all the time. And they came to meetings, and everybody in the local people knew them. And his, my Bob Swanson's kids were about the same age, and they would just hang out together. And, you know, the dinner table discussion was this. So, I mean, there was a question on there that you didn't ask of who's my mentor, you know. And in fact, it's Nick is a lot of that, because we, in our dinner table discussion was, we didn't dumb our dinner table discussions down, you know, because we had two children there. You know, they learned all this and grew up to be absolutely fabulous, progressive, wonderful people and weren't hurt by it. But, you know, it was difficult, and the biggest difficult decision, I don't know how people do it now with the cost of childcare, but but the biggest difficult decision was when I decided to run for bargaining, because that was, David was 12, which is a difficult age, and he didn't always get along so great with Nick at that point. And Katie was 15, and she was always perfect. you know, that was a difficult decision. And I did find that when I came home, sometime, you know, there were some problems. You know, David and Nick could be a little contentious with each other sometimes. But we bought a dishwasher because they were fighting so much about who did the dishes. But Nick, if anything, was almost more supportive than he should have. I mean, he pushed me to do some things that I probably would not have decided to do if he hadn't. He really wanted me to run for Irvine's spot. So, you know, I think we had a different attitude towards child rearing than a lot of kids now. And, you know, they turned out fine. So, We balanced it, and I don't remember exactly how we did it sometimes, but we definitely, I think the key thing was to bring them that as much as we were part of their lives in terms of soccer practice, and Katie did theater, and we tried to make it to every single thing we could. But the other half of that was that they were absolutely part of our lives, and loved being part of that.
Thank you. This is great.